This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
I'm Wong Xiaoning, and this is The Breakfast Grill. We hear this phrase, new normal, in the coronavirus era, and know there are many adjustments that have to be made. But what does this mean for us, and how much economic pain does this involve? To help us answer that question and provide some solutions is Dr. Nung Sariradi, a man who over 30 years has been in academia, corporate advisory, economic research, an MP, and until very recently, chairman of MAFCOM and Khazanah Research Institute. Now, thank you for joining us on the line today, Dr. Nung.
Thank you for having me.
Like I said a minute ago, you were both chairman of MAFCOM and Khazanah Research Institute just not too long ago, and even on the board of MARA. Now, is this once again politics that you are no longer in those positions? And you would think that in this era, right, the government should be focusing 110% on the coronavirus, but yet it still has time to replace key positions. Is this a sad state of affairs?
Well, I'll just comment on my situation. Actually, in the government appointments that I was in, I was a member of the Majlis Mara. Like you said, I chaired the board of trustees of the Khazanah Research Institute. I was the executive chairman, which is an executive position of the Aviation Commission. And I also sat on another board, on the public sector housing board. So when I was removed, actually, from the Mara Council, and then subsequently was asked to stand down from Khazanah Research Institute, almost in succession, then I thought, well, just to be consistent, I should stand down from all the other two as well, which is what I did. I didn't take it personally. And if you don't want me to be sitting on those positions, then, you know, it's your call. It's okay.
But Dr. Nung, do you think that as a country that is, you know, we've been independent for more than 60 years, that we still continue to play this game of political patronage? How do we move away from this so that we really get the best people in the jobs, be it whether it is a GLC, GLIC, or even a statutory body?
Yeah, unfortunately, we have not moved that far since the beginning, maybe for 60 years. I think statutory bodies, whether they are authorities, majlis, Suruhanjaya, all these things, they are creatures of parliaments, right? So by right, members of parliament who should have oversight over these statutory creatures should not be on the board of these things. Because if you are a sitting MP, you shouldn't be on the board of the very entity that you're supposed to have oversight on. So limits of authorities and separation of powers would mean that if you are MP overseeing the performance of creatures of parliament, which are statutory bodies, you shouldn't be sitting on the boards of those entities yourselves. So, by right, sitting MPs should not be sitting on any statutory bodies. Now, on companies, sometimes we call statutory bodies GLC as well. On companies, on public companies, whether notwithstanding whoever the shareholders are, I think that's left to the shareholders. Private companies, fine. Sitting MPs can sit on private companies if they want. But there is a term called PEP, you know, politically exposed persons in banking. So if you're a public listed companies and you have sitting MPs on your board, that would say quite a bit about that company. That's why most companies don't put PEPs on their boards. So MPs, I think, have a problem of not having much to do. So what they should do is actually they should have all these committees and meet and have oversight over these statutory bodies as instead of just chasing to be on the boards of these statutory bodies. That ought to change. I think it changed a bit in the last government, but they didn't proceed as much as they should, I think.
Well, with this new PN government, we have seen quite a lot of changes, even at the GLC and GLIC level, very quickly. So actually, to be honest, both sides of the political divide are equally guilty of this, right? Realistically, is there any way to move away from this, especially if I look at it from a GLC perspective? Because it takes a while for a company to implement what is the right strategic direction. and you want talent. So if you assume that this post is a revolving one, that after 5 years I could be replaced, then you're always going to get maybe never the best person for the job, right? Because if the person is truly talented and maybe works at a large MNC now, will be hesitant to join.
Yes, that's true. I think for investee companies or funds of EPF, PNB, Tabung Haji, all these big funds, you know, we used to have this. I mean, when I was in Khazanah, we used to have these different colored books that should govern those things. So that's why the NRC, Nominating and Remuneration Committee of the Board, these are public listed companies. It should function independently, right? And shareholders, they want to influence choices of directors or executives who should be leading this company. Then they should be doing the influencing via their nominees on the board. So the process should be very transparent. So that should be the case. Then you can attract the best talent, because people know that you don't get kicked out just because there's a change in government. We need to put those in place. But about the statutory bodies, that's why Parliament should be sitting and really looking at these things. They should be looking at the statutes themselves. You know, like in corporate governance, we have fit and proper tests. Unfortunately, in a lot of statutory entities, those are not very, not spelled out quite clearly. So a lot of politicians get to be sitting on board of these things, which is actually not right. I mean, I was in Mara for over a year. I could see why... I could see what happened and how it evolved in ways that it shouldn't. And I think partly because it was mainly seen as a political tool as opposed to a developmental institution.
And Dr. Nung, you brought up Parliament. As we know, it's only sitting for one day. Are you concerned about that, so that really there is no check and balance?
Okay, that's one thing. There should be check and balance. But under the present circumstances, Parliament should be sitting and considering and drafting and passing laws particular to this COVID thing, right? I mean, Singapore recently passed a COVID sort of act because, under the present situation, companies have all kinds of liabilities, right? Contractual liabilities and so on that they are concerned about. So there should be a law that says something about those things, about how these liabilities are to be seen and to be regulated within the context of the MCO and this pandemic itself. And then there's also workers and employees' rights and so on. So I think Parliament should sit, because the business of Parliament is exactly this, actually, to look at laws that is relevant to the prevailing circumstances. So they should. And secondly, the extent to which government can do things in terms of helping out people who are in need of help, depends on the budget. The budget that was approved last year for budget 2020 has certainly is out of the window. Right? If it's a company, that budget is gone, right? All the assumptions in that budget is gone. So you should actually present a new budget and get a consensus of what needs to be done. You cannot be doing things under a different set of circumstances now in the next 6 months, the next 8 months, based on the assumptions being made last year when the budget was passed. So there's a lot of reason for why Parliament should be sitting and sitting properly. I mean, they don't have to sit physically. You know, the House of Commons is sitting virtually. So you can sit and consider business and do things, because there's a lot of business to do.
Well, maybe they are concerned about other issues, one of which is whether, you know, the current government has the required majority. I'm not sure. But if we could perhaps pivot to your time when you were executive chairman of MAVCOM. So tell us very quickly, you know, what is your view of the aviation sector in this era of COVID-19? Is it doomed?
I tell you, it's totally decimated, actually. The aviation industry globally is totally decimated. MAVCOM, before I left, we published a technical paper about this, and then we also wrote to the minister about our views on these things. To me, the writing was on the wall. I think airlines globally expanded fleets like crazy. They bought all kinds of planes. It's been good for travelers in terms of the competition has lowered down the price. But they were susceptible to fluctuations in costs. One is actually fuel costs, which ironically has basically gone down. But this loss in revenue is gone. Airlines sell tickets 1 year ahead and spend today, right? Mm. So now they cannot spend, they cannot sell. So they cannot sell tomorrow or next month or next year. So they don't have any cash at all. I think any restructuring of the local airlines, the four big ones, Asia, Asia X, Malaysian Airlines and Malindo, have to take into account of the reconfiguration of airlines globally and definitely regionally, because all the other airlines in the region and in the world will have to reconfigure itself. Any restructuring on our side will have to be part of that global restructuring. And that's going on, I think. It's a mess, though. It's a big, big mess.
So, Dr. Nong, does it make sense for AirAsia and Malaysian Airlines to actually merge? After all, they're both in dire straits at this moment, right?
Well, I think one is actually the question of issues of competition and consumer welfare afterwards, right? If that were to be the case, by right, there are two different entities, Asia X and Asia. But if you look at that
as a group,
one and the same as a group, then basically three airlines collapsing to become one, right?
Mm.
That's one of the issues that we alluded to. It can be done, but it has to be seen in the context of future competition and consumer welfare. Because the issue is actually, what do we want as a country? We want connectivity. We want services. We want competitive prices. So the issue is how best to get those things, right? So the other question that we need to answer is actually, do we need a national airline? So if we just want connectivity, good service, competitive prices, we can achieve those things more flexibly, I suppose. Then if you say, oh, I need a national airline, I need a low-cost airline, then you have too many conditionalities to achieve what? To achieve what's connectivity, to achieve competitive prices. So I think they should have a big power, a big conversation. But regulators, I suppose, will have to look at both issues of competition as well as consumer side as well.
And Dr. Nu, one of the last statements issued by MAVCOM when it was still under your watch did exactly stir some of this controversy, right? When I think there was a statement asking where you decided to be lenient with the airlines who are unable to meet that regulatory deadline in giving refunds to passengers who booked on flights. Now, the optics here came across as, you know, MAVCOM was actually protecting the airlines versus the consumers. I mean, was that fair, or was that just necessary because of market conditions?
Well, people have short memories in these sort of things. But MAVCOM has created the Aviation Consumer Protection Code and been enforcing it. In fact, some of the things that we have gotten with the airlines are actually because we have been enforcing it, you know, on behalf of consumers. You know, charges, refunds, and things like that. But because of the COVID situation, part of the MACPC was to say that any refunds ought to be done within 30 days. So the airlines actually wrote in to ask for an extension of that. So we did not absolve them from having to do the refund. We're just extending the 30 days. So, of course, then all kinds of people start jumping around saying, accusing MAVCOM of being pro-airlines and forgetting that in the past, MAVCOM has actually been on the side of consumers. But airlines are totally, they're not flying. They're not having any cash flow. They've grounded all their fleet. They're not selling tickets. Not selling tickets today, not selling tickets next week, and so on. So, you know, I have to be realistic as well, right?
You're listening to The Breakfast Grill, where I'm speaking to economist Dr. Nong Sari Radi, who until very recently was the chairman of MAVCOM and Khazanah Research Institute. Up next, what's the best way to reduce the economic scar tissue caused by COVID-19? BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Breakfast Grill, where I'm speaking to economist Dr. Nong Sari Radi, who was until very recently the executive chairman of MAVCOM and also chairman of Khazanah Research Institute. Now, just a moment ago, we were talking about the Malaysian aviation sector, or what's left of it, and is moving away from political patronage and impossibility. Now, Dr. Nong, I want to look now at the cost of flattening that coronavirus curve. And this is based on your article in the Edge Weekly. You remind us, I think very importantly, that the cost is not the same for everyone. Yes, we are equal to the infection in that everyone can get it. But in reality, the consequences of limited economic activity is definitely not equal. So are you worried that the gulf actually will widen between the B40s and the T40s? I mean, especially for those petty traders, right? Those employed on a daily basis, those who earn a daily wage.
This pandemic will make worse what was already bad in terms of inequality because the MCO has basically made the most the lower end of our society to be the most vulnerable people. So that's why I actually, earlier on, I think, wrote an open letter to the Prime Minister, co-authored with two other guys, because I was concerned that they were not acting fast enough to provide a floor to these people, right? Because people living in PPR flats, pasar malam, petty traders, they are literally, it's a survival issue. Your question about inequality, yes, this will create more inequality. And because the economy will recover, I think, very, very slowly out of this, the inequality will also be between age groups, right? I think young people will get hit more than older people because jobs creation will not be as fast to absorb younger people who enter the job market. So there's inequality in terms of strata, but there's also inequality in terms of demographic, in terms of age, I think, going forward.
But how can we help them? I mean, if we look at, firstly, let's say we focus now on the B40s, right? So we've had pre-Hartin packages. But I think my concern is, you know, Makcik Kia and Pakcik Saleh, right, which has been referred to by our Prime Minister. They've had a bit of cash, but now how are they going to make a living, which is the main issue, isn't it? Because, yes, you can give them a handout, but they'll spend it very soon.
Yep. I mean,
What policy options can we offer them?
The pictures of long queues in front of pawn shops just confirms that the people don't have cash. So this is the real problem. That's why some people are talking about, you know, universal basic income, because they need support, literally. Because I think the Prihatin packages 1, 2, and 3, I think, is sufficient for that time. It was designed for an MCO of 4 weeks, the calculations of it. But now the MCO has gone to about 6 or 8 weeks. And then beyond this, it's not just going to recover like that, right? So we need to keep on pumping this this cash, literally, I think. That's what other countries have done.
So does this mean, Dr. Nung, you're actually in favour of the recent lifting of restrictions? So we are now in this conditional MCO period, right? You think it's a good thing? Because, you know, Malaysians seem to be very divided on this. They seem to be very concerned that we'll get another wave of infections and the cost of that outweighs the economic benefits. What do you think?
Well, I think while the response to mitigate, to manage the outbreak has to be national and centralized, the recovery process has to be decentralized, right? Areas for which authorities are able to control should get started. Life has to go on. We cannot just be waiting. I mean, I'm not being philosophical or anything, but the human species have gotten to where we are today by actually adapting ourselves to situations. So we have to. It's also about poorer people needs to get out there to work, to earn a living, as opposed to people who can afford to stay at home. They can be more judgmental, I suppose. But it's also about getting used to these things, right? The whole point of the MCO was to flatten the curve, to ensure that the health system is not overwhelmed. I think we've done that. So we have SOP, we have to ensure that those are being enforced.
But Dr. Nung, there's also been some criticism with regards to the government in terms of the SOPs. They say, some people say it's not clear enough. It was a bit rushed. What do you think? Yeah. Was it not communicated properly, or maybe more time should have been spent on the final details?
I think conceptually, I agree. I said what I said. But in details, in implementation, I think it was a bit of a rush, isn't it? It was like announced and it was supposed to be on the 12th that we ended, and then suddenly you say, oh, okay, tomorrow is okay. So I think they could do better in terms of the implementation and the SOPs, right? In terms of the sequencing, in terms of communication, they could do better. That one, I definitely agree. And I'm still wondering how the various local authorities and states and enforcement agencies are going to go around enforcing those SOPs. That's the other big question. But we have to, I've been listening to the DG of Health, right? I mean, he is basically trying to say this is a social responsibility, which is true. If we as a collective are not very compliant to this sort of thing, we're not concerned about other people, then I think there will be a spike and then everybody will be at risk again. If you look at countries that are quite disciplined, have strong social discipline, have handled it better than countries who say, oh, let me do what I want. You know what some of those countries are.
But at the same time, those countries which have actually emerged from a lockdown in better shape, okay, or where the citizens tend to be, I would say the word obedient, right, or more, you know, conscious of the social contract that they have with their other citizens, also tend to have a lot of faith in the integrity of the institutions of the country. So examples of this are like Germany, New Zealand. Yep. So what does that say about Malaysia then?
Yeah, you're right, actually. At the end of the day, how much do we trust the institution, right? Especially public institution? And it's interesting that you raised this issue in the context of the first question you asked, which is actually about governance of public institutions, which is about, you know, people patronage, about putting politicians on the board of public institutions, as opposed to legislators playing the role of legislating and overseeing the performance of public institutions. They shouldn't be part of it. So the first part of your question actually is very pertinent in terms of people's confidence on public institutions. People are confident, they will abide, right? They will comply. They will believe. So that's true. That's a good point, though. I don't really have an answer to that.
And Dr. Nung, you know, in a way, the COVID-19 creates almost a blank piece of paper, right? Because we have to restart so many things. Now, if you had a wish list, and I'm sure you have one, what are some of the structural reforms or, you know, that we can actually relook in terms of our economy? There are many structural issues we face. I'm sure low wages, low productivity. But what would you like redone?
I think a couple of things. One, I think the digitization thing. I think this just goes to show that we need the digitization agenda to go quickly, and it should reach, it should be pervasive, it should go all the way down. If these petty traders are just going to rely on their ability to push through their products through normal traditional supply chain channels, they're not going to make it. I mean, I happen to know these people who grow vegetables in Cameron Highlands. They were affected because of the disruption in Selayang and so on, were not able to be bought by the wholesalers and to be distributed, and they lost all their harvest. But they were those who were able to use the digital platform to sell directly. So I think the digitization is one thing. If it's pervasive enough, there will be all kinds of possibilities. So that's one. Secondly, actually, back to the supply chain. I think the supply chain has fragmented and globalized too much. And I think one of the other lessons that we could do is actually to localize supply chains a bit, especially for food. So we should look at that as a potential growth area after this. And the third area, I think, is actually this whole business of migrant labor and so on. And the reliance on foreign labor and perhaps on manual foreign labor is something that we have to get out of.
And Dr. Nung, I want to end on a slightly more positive note, right? I know it's a reality. We are facing tough times ahead. But do you have any message of hope for us Malaysians?
I will be disappointed because when I was a lot younger, I was waiting for the year 2020 because I knew we were going to be 60 and I thought we were going to be, you know, Negara Maju and all these things. And then now here we are and I'm 60, 2020. It's kind of bad. but you see, what you need to do is actually to open up spaces. You have to believe that the human ingenuity and human need and creativity that comes from need will take over, and you have to facilitate that. And I think the possibilities that can happen, we don't even know yet, but we have to open it up. We have to make sure people are okay, and then we have to open it up. We don't have to be so controlling and whatnot. I always believe in the human ingenuity, human creativity, with the proviso that they're given the freedom to do that.
On that note, thank you for sharing your views with us today. Joining us on The Breakfast Grill this morning was Dr. Nung Sari Radi, an academic and ex-MP, policymaker, and until very recently, chairman of Khazanah Research Institute and also executive chairman of MAVCOM. I'm Wong Xiaoning, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, encouraging you to stay home during this period of movement control.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.